Hello, and welcome to Evergreen Pinecone Podcast, where we have conversations about issues that are important to you, like faith and family, religion and relationships, Christianity and the church, and a whole lot more. So grab a cup of coffee or your favorite drink, sit back, relax, and enjoy Art and Wes as they have a conversation on Evergreen Pinecone Podcast. Welcome to the Evergreen Pinecone Podcast. This is our inaugural podcast. I'm Art Stump, member of Evergreen Church, and I'm here with Wes White, the pastor of Evergreen Church. How you doing, Wes?
Doing really well. How about you?
Doing great. Good to see you this afternoon.
You too.
Where we are. Mm-hmm. So this afternoon, we're going to be talking about flourishing families. And you did recently do a sermon series on that, and a lot of it was based on Ephesians 5. And I thought it was interesting, down in that chapter, Paul starts talking about wives and husbands and families. But the very first verse, which I'm sure you remember, be imitators of God as dearly loved children and live a life of love, just as Christ loved us and gave himself up for us as a fragrant offering and sacrifice to God. That might be the summary at the end, but I just thought that was interesting that he started right off, be imitators of God and love just as Christ loved us. So since we're talking flourishing families, and that's probably going to lead to marriage and children and parenting and all that, but let's start off, define that for us, Wes. What is a flourishing family?
Well, I definitely will get into marriage because I actually think that marriage is the heart of a flourishing family. So, but, you know, let me just say up front, why do we want to talk about flourishing families? Well, we want our families to flourish. We want our families to do well. And we live in a day in which the family has a lot of struggles, especially in our nation. You know, you just look at the divorce rate. You look at how many children are, more and more children living with a single parent, and a lot of families breaking up. And so it's a question in a lot of people's mind, how do we make our families flourish? So,
right.
And what does it look like if our families are flourishing is the question you're asking. Well, I think that as I see it, and in my mind's eye, I think of a flourishing family as everyone being loved and accepted for who they are and allowed to be themselves or selves. And also to be able to develop their gifts and to get help and encouragement in developing their gifts and serving in the world. And I would add a theological component that this is all done to the glory of God, that there's a transcendent purpose for the family. The family's not just focusing in on itself. It has a goal outside itself and even a transcendent purpose, which I would identify with God himself as the goal to glorify him.
Right.
Is there anything you might add to that?
No, thank you. I think you summed it up. I'm thinking though about, and I don't want to stray too far from talking about flourishing families, but the family obviously is under attack. You were talking about in our world today. And we hear so much, especially recently, maybe on the news about, you know, blaming politics or political parties or thing like that, when really the enemy's Satan. But why do you think Satan so intently attacks the family?
Well, the family is the basic building block of society. Right at the beginning of creation, God establishes the family, and it's the incubator of the next generation. That's where kids grow up. So if that is off kilter, then the whole next generation is going to have issues. And so if we can help our families flourish and we help our kids flourish, we help the next generation flourish, and that has ripple effects through the generations.
Good. Yeah, I like that. Great. That's a great answer. I also think about how God paints a picture of his relationship to us through the family. You know, is comparing, saying, as Christ dies or loves the church to love your life. And if Satan can destroy the family in a way, he could kind of destroy that picture of how we relate to God.
You're a lot more theological than I am. I'm just the pastor.
No, that's not it. That's not it at all. So what, okay, so how do we make a family flourish? How does, you know, I often hear marriage, if we, like you said, that's kind of the basis or the building block of it. And you always hear marriage should be 50-50. Well, I think that's wrong. Marriage should be 100% and 100% from both. But in your thoughts, how does that happen? How do we make the marriage flourish so the family can flourish?
Well, you think about a family that is not doing well, where there's, you know, people are not talking to each other, or, you know, there's people aren't able to work. They feel like it's a place of threat rather than acceptance, a dysfunctional family. And so the question is, how do you turn that around? Now I think you have other questions when the family is functional.
Right.
It's how do you make it better? And that we come back to that. The answer is fundamentally the same. Most people tend to look at their families and blame. And they say, they look at their parents as causing their problems, or their spouse as the issue. They see frustrations with their kids or with their grandparents or their parents. And there's no doubt that family is something where we all play a part. But when I look at the Bible, I see that the Bible's approach is that it doesn't just say wait for other people to do the right thing, wait for other people to relate in the right way. It comes, for example, in Ephesians 5 that we're talking about. Mm-hmm. It says love your wives, respect your husbands. It doesn't say if they're respectable or if they're loving, then do so. It says that you're just to do that. And I think that that's actually the heart. If we think of the relationship as a system where people kind of build together, if one person can begin to function differently in a way that is different than what they did before, then generally that will alter the whole system. So you don't have to wait for anybody else to make the family better. You can begin by functioning in a better way or more mature way, a more healthy way, a healthier way, right away. So I think that that's the key, is that one person really has to take responsibility. And the more central that person is to the system, the more effect that will have. That's why I think we begin with husbands and wives. So if we just say like a 5-year-old child, even if they could, you know, have enough reflection to say, I'm going to function differently, they don't have as much effect as mom or dad saying, I'm going to function differently in this system. So we got to start to ask, how am I reacting? What am I doing? How do I contribute to this situation as it is?
What if one spouse is completely disconnected from the marriage? Not like abuse. You know, I know that's a totally different thing, or not like, you know, infidelity or things, but just completely, like maybe through substance abuse or through just whatever, just completely disconnected. Or maybe the husband is always at work and never at home. So I know there's all kinds of different dynamics there, but how do I begin to relate and put into practice what you're saying when my spouse is completely disconnected from the marriage?
So I think that in my view, you know, if someone is what I would call distancing within a marriage or within a relationship, that you recognize that usually doesn't occur in a vacuum, that there is two parts to that.
Right.
And sometimes, like, some psychologists will speak of the pursuer distancer. And so it's almost like one person has to be taking a certain amount of initiative in the relationship, and that person becomes the pursuer. And then you have the distancer who moves away, and the pursuer keeps following, and the distancer moves away, and there always is sort of the same distance between them. And what's interesting in that is that you find that if that gets turned around and the distancer decides, I'm going to start moving towards that person, then they actually end up moving away. It's because you're comfortable with a certain distance from people. So how do you overcome that? I think that you have to ask, again, what sort of... There's so many different ways in which this can happen. You have to ask, what sort of things am I doing in this relationship that contribute to the distancing? And how could I function differently in a way that might help us move forward, or at least free myself from the pain that is continually occurring?
You can't change the other person, change yourself.
Yeah, that's right.
So, or change how you react to it.
That's right.
Right.
So I'll give you an example of this. In our family today, you know, one of my daughters said that she had come up with an idea. She had come up with an idea. And then my other daughter said, no, you didn't come up with that. And so the daughter who thought she had come up with it was in tears and very angry. And she comes and she talks to mom and says, she won't recognize that this is my idea.
Yeah.
And the other person is just kind of distancing, you might say, well, whatever, why is that so important to you? And so what is pushing that situation is really that person's concern for the other person agreeing with them. If that daughter of mine could have a little bit less concern about the other agreeing with them, then there wouldn't be that sort of dance of attack and conflict and counterattack and so on. So it's a matter of getting independence, but I also would say that independence is not disconnecting. Like you say, if she thinks something differently, that's okay, and I'm still going to connect with her and love her and talk to her. Then you have a relationship that's based on allowing people to be where they are and grow together and think through things, rather than everybody having to be the same and do the same, which is a recipe for a lot of anxiety and a lot of conflict and a lot of symptoms in a family.
Yeah. Good. So 2 weeks ago, we're 2 weeks away from Valentine's Day. And Valentine's Day was 2 weeks ago. How did you do on your end with the...
I have a feeling you actually know the answer to that. So
I do. Someone listening might not.
That's right. I know. That is. So one of the things that I think that we have to remember when we're relating, when we're talking about marriages, is that husbands and wives have different needs and different perspectives on things. And it's easy to let our own perspective kind of dominate what we think we should do to the other person. And I actually said, and I'm really ashamed of this now that I've actually reflected on it. I said to my wife prior to Valentine's Day, we're not really big Valentine's Day people.
And of course she agreed.
No, as soon as I said it, I realized, like, that is me doing exactly what we've been talking about, yeah, where I'm imposing my perspective. And I realized, like, Valentine's Day is not a big deal to most men. But it is a big deal to most wives. And I think that probably the degree to which we're thinking about the others is shown somewhat by how well we do Valentine's Day. And what's interesting is that my wife shared with me that she had, growing up, seen people get gifts on Valentine's Day, and she was always... It's looking forward to Valentine's Day. So I really did not realize the degree. I mean, I've really totally done a terrible job. And the first Valentine's Day where we were together, she was really excited. And she said, I just couldn't wait to see what this is going to be like. You know, my first Valentine's Day, really, at where I've had a boyfriend, or I think we're engaged at the time.
Yeah.
And I got sick and nothing happened. So, and that's basically set the pattern.
So you got a pass on that one.
Yeah, I did get a pass on that one. That's right. But I recovered. And finally, after 18 years of marriage, and now I've tried to do a little better. And what's funny is I was talking to another friend of mine, and I said, so I started asking guys, what are you doing for Valentine's Day? Just see the reaction.
Yeah.
And exact same response. We're not really big on Valentine's. And I said, what that means is you're not really big on Valentine's, which is pretty normal. And one of the, so when you think about kind of the things you picture for Valentine's Day, you think of getting flowers or jewelry or candy or candlelight dinner, you know,
right.
Getting things for your wife to care for herself, like a bath bomb or right. a massage or whatever.
Right.
And those things really communicate to her, and that's how we love our wives. But I think when we, one of the things is you notice in Ephesians 5, is it says, husbands, love your wives. And it doesn't say, wives, love your husbands, even though I think they're required to do so.
Yeah.
It emphasizes, wives, respect your husbands. And I think that that shows that there's something different that is needed for a wife to show love to her husband. And so, like, if on Valentine's Day, a wife comes in and has a nice candlelit dinner and brings flowers to her husband's and chocolates and not chocolate might be okay, but
you might react to that, but not
and says, I've got a bath bomb for you.
Yeah.
I mean, you're just going to look at her and say, what is going on here? You know? And so it's just not going to communicate to you in the way that will to her. And I think the whole holiday is one that's kind of geared towards women. And that's fine. So, but if you're going to communicate to men, probably something different, you know, is a way that you show them love and touch their hearts, you might say.
Right. So, I take it Melinda didn't get you a bath bomb.
Right. No, she did not. In fact, yeah. I think she might have got me some chocolates, so. That's okay. I like chocolate.
She knows you well. I did for the first time, and this is bad because, you know, I have a 26-year-old daughter that I have daughters that are 11 and 14, and this Valentine's Day was the first time I'd ever done anything for either of the three of them. And,
wow.
And for the two younger ones, I did get them a card and like a little chocolate bar. And again, an iTunes gift card, and set it on their beds when they came home. And their reaction was pretty amazing. That they, you know, I figured they'd be like, yeah, whatever, but they didn't. They really appreciated that and were surprised by that, I think.
Yeah, well, I think that's why we're gonna rename this podcast. Instead of calling it Pinecone, we'll kind of call it Two Recovering Chauvinist Pigs.
Well, yeah. Well, that's okay. We learned.
That's right. We learned.
Even that's why I say
recovering. We're not just chauvinist pigs. We're recovering chauvinist pigs. That's like we're working on it. Working on being better.
How does you? I mean, I gotta know the answer. I'm just setting this up so you can say. But how does your relationship with your spouse affect your kids as far as the parents, as far as they see from their parents, like talk about how that affects how your relationship that you saw with your parents, and I don't necessarily mean you, but more in general terms, how our people that we see from our parents, how that affects how we treat our kids, how we treat our spouse.
Well, I'd rather talk about my parents and why they caused all my problems.
Yeah, that's why.
But
your parents would say your problems are your own.
that's right. And not my kids' problems, right?
Yeah.
So if you go back to the beginning where marriage was instituted, Genesis chapter 2, the key verse there is Genesis 2, I think verse 24, where it says that for this reason a man will leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. And so the design of marriage is one of where the husband and wife connect with one another on a deep and intimate level that, as you said earlier, reflects our relationship with God and is right. meant to point to that. And the Apostle Paul gets a lot of mileage out of that in chapter 5 there. So, but how one way I think about that is to say that that shows us that the if you have a spouse, then that husband or wife needs to be the priority in terms of human relationships. And when that is not the case, then that discord or disjointedness tends to work out throughout the generations. And the reason why is because what happens is that if the husband and wife aren't the priority in each other's lives, then generally someone else or something will be. And oftentimes the kids get brought into that, and then they bear a weight in the family constellation that they're not meant to bear. So one way that I've heard people speak of it is keep the generations in the generations. So you know the problem where you know the husband and wife get married, and every time there's a difficult thing that happens, the husband or the wife goes back to mom to get comfort, and that is very distressing to the marriage. Right. So, but it can work the other direction too. As the child grows up and you have that special relationship with the child, if your relationship with your spouse feels uncomfortable, and then you have a child with whom you connect who's right there, then they almost can become like the spouse in terms of they become the priority. But that distorts the relationship of parent and child. And I'm not sure all the reasons why that is the case, but I think that generally you'll observe that that's not good for the marriage, and then it's not good for the rest of the family.
It's not good for the kid. It also can happen, you said, in a sense that the child could become a spouse, and I don't know what you mean, that in a sense of relating. It can also, the child, if one spouse relates too much to the child on that level, and the child develops that relationship with that parent, and then the other parent, for whatever reason, goes away, divorce, death, whatever might happen, and then suppose another relationship is introduced into that, or even if it's not. But then that parent-child relationship has changed. That dynamic's going to change, and that can confuse the child. Like,
oh, yeah.
What happened? You know, all of a sudden, I don't have that. So it can happen both ways.
And there's always anxiety when a new person enters into the family system.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, especially if it disrupts a really close relationship, that's only going to amplify that.
Yeah. And like you said, everybody has a tendency to want to go back to what they're familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I don't want to ask this question. This is one that we kind of talked about like beforehand, before we did this, because I don't want to think that I mean this towards your parents, because you just now said I don't want to blame my parents for my problems. But what happens when you have a situation where your parents continually disappoint, you know, a child? Where that's a bad relationship. Maybe that not continually disappoint you as a child, but their relationship's disappointing. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and well, I think in some ways that all relationships are going to disappoint, because we have big aspirations, we have big needs for acceptance, for love, for security, for guidance, for finding purpose, and we value other people and the input they have, and so every relationship will disappoint. And what I would say is that, so I think that parents are a big deal. That's one of the things that I think that we need to consider, is that this doesn't mean we blame them for who we are, because we had our part in relationship too. And we continue to play a part. We continue to create the relationship together.
Mm-hmm.
But parents are, as one of my friends put it, big trees in our forest. They matter. And if you are a parent, which I know you are,
right,
like, you matter in the lives of your daughters. That's really significant. And so if people tend to when they feel stressed, kind of think they're a little kid, you know, again. But even when they're parents and when they have their own children. And so I think one of the big things for us to recognize is that I am a father. I actually am. And that really matters in the life of my kids.
Right.
So that's one direction we can talk about it in terms of the how that affects how we view our children. But how does it affect how we look at our own parents? So one thing is we should not deny that our parents matter. Like, even if they were horrible parents, that really matters. That's really significant. That was something that shaped us. But, you know, most parents aren't horrible. They have their mistakes. But taken as a whole, parents have their problems, but they also are an incredible resource for us as well. But I think that one of the things that a lot of us haven't done as adults is to really come to grips with sort of unresolved issues in how we relate to our parents, or come to peace with relating to our parents. So if our parents, for example, let's just say they're not working and they're always having financial trouble. And to feel that, and then they kind of have maybe in the past leaned on you to help them, and that's been going on since you were a kid. I think part of one way that you might begin to think of it is, well, what if I said I'm not going to take care of you, or put it more positively, I actually believe you have the resources to take care of yourself, and so I'm not going to take that responsibility any longer. Now you do that, and they're not going to be happy. They're going to go after you. But if you can learn to do that, and you can learn to say, I'm okay with them struggling. I'm okay with them kind of working it out on their own, which they usually do, you know. Then you can actually gain a lot of maturity, not only in relationship to your parents, but in relationship to everybody else,
right,
as well. So I think it's important to say, how do I relate to my parents in a way that is not reactive to them, but also learns to keep connected with them and right, value them.
Right. Should I let my kids struggle? Or should I try to fix everything for them?
Oh, you should definitely fix everything for them. Because that's what you're here for, you know?
Okay. Okay. That's for podcast number two. But no, really, I know you don't mean that. So what's your real answer?
Well, there's, if you want to do that, then why do people want to fix other people? Probably because they have anxiety.
It's their own anxiety
about the situation, and then they want to fix it, and then to make themselves feel better. But
if I fix everything for them, they'll never learn how to fix it for themselves. Right.
That's right. There's an analogy of this in the animal world that's always good to think about, and that is the caterpillar and the butterfly. You know, the caterpillar builds this cocoon, and they have to struggle to get out of it in order to be, you know, come out as that butterfly. And so it'd be easy for some sympathetic person to come by and say, "Oh, I'm going to help it get out of that cocoon." The trouble is, it's that struggle that enables them to get the strength to actually be able to fly. And I think that is just a perfect metaphor for what parenting is. Now, again, we don't want to disconnect from them, but we got to allow them to struggle. And again, not in the case like, you know, if your 2-year-old's playing with a chainsaw.
Well,
a running chainsaw. You know, you want to stop that, you know.
Don't let them figure that one out.
Yeah, that's right. There's some things, you know, you draw appropriate boundaries. But most of the things we're dealing with are not like that. So just to give you one quick example, a basic axiom that I've established is, don't do for your kids what they can do for themselves.
Okay.
Because then you deprive them of the ability, both the learning effort and also the sense of accomplishment that comes from doing something themselves. So one of my youngest daughter the other day was going to make some bagels or toast or something.
Yeah.
And she couldn't, and she tried initially to get the toaster down, the toast down, you know, whatever, push that button.
Right.
I don't know what it's called anyway. But it's like you have to slide it down. Yeah. Anyways, we'll do our next podcast on toasters, right?
Yeah.
So she's like, I can't do it, you know, do it for me. And but I realized she can do this. I think she can do this. And so, you know, I let her work with it, and eventually she did. Then I always say to them, after they've said to me, I can't do it, you know, then I say, no, I think you can. And then they do it. Then I say, remember that. You thought you couldn't do it. You have a lot more in you than you think.
Right.
So it reminds me of, you were actually with me on that hike that we did up Mount LeConte, where I took my kids for the first time. So you remember that
to the restaurant? Is that where you're gonna?
No. So one of the things about we hiked Mount LeConte, which is like, I think the first time we did it was like a 13-14 mile hike, and like my kids, generally if we did a mile hike,
they would say already
they're out. But two of my kids, to their credit, said we want to do it, and we're gonna do it. You know, and they got that vision of we can do it. So they take this 14-mile hike with us, and it was a great hike. But they did it. And so I love, because, you know, Mount LeConte here where we are in Sevier County, in the beautiful place, always is on the horizon. So whenever I'm with them and we kind of see a view of Mount LeConte, then I always point to that and I say, remember, you hiked that.
You did that, yeah.
And you've got a lot more in you than you think.
Yeah.
So I always say... I always think we need to encourage people. We see something good, encourage people, but especially our kids.
I definitely agree. I was thinking of another, it might not have been a hike, but when we were at a restaurant, like a fast food place, and you let Virginia go up, and I could still see her. You gave her money to go up and like order a Frosty or something, maybe from Wendy's.
Yeah.
And everybody around her was looking like,
this is 5-year-old kid. You know,
where this kid's parents at?
Just comes up on her own. That's right.
But she
did
it. Yeah.
That's right. And then she's like, I can do this, right. You know? So that's what, I want them to see that God has gifted them with a lot of gifts and potential. I mean, you know, another talk, we can talk about sin, you know, but they're also created in the image of God, and humans are problem-solving machines, as one person put it. And people need to see that about themselves, because we don't believe that about ourselves a lot of times. So
That's so true. That's a great way to kind of wrap up our first Pinecone podcast.
Yeah, it's been fun.
It was fun. Appreciate you chatting about flourishing families this morning. Although it's this afternoon, obviously I can't tell time either. I was just going to wrap it up by just, you know, we talked a lot more about children and parents, I think, maybe than we did husbands and wives. But, I started off with the first verse in Ephesians chapter 5. I was going to read the last couple verses in light of in Genesis 2:18, when God said it's not good for man to be alone, and I will make a helper suitable for him. And then Paul writes, closing out that chapter 5, for this reason a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. This is a profound mystery, but I'm talking about Christ and the church. But then he says, however, each one of you must love his wife as he loves himself, and his wife must respect her husband. Great words for today, and great words for any day. Thanks again, Wes. Thanks for everybody for listening. We will catch you next time on the Pinecone Podcast. So thank you.